Hello and welcome to Radically Distinct Radio. This is your host, Jen Morgan. And today I have a super special guest. Her name is Jess Tupper. She is Seattle's dessert geek, a microblogger, photographer, and social media expert, and honestly, one of the most articulate people I've ever met. And today is so special because she is going to coach me in how to taste a dessert. How to taste a dessert and respond to it like I know what I'm talking about. And she's going to give all of us some tips on how to find our voice in social media.
This is going to be awesome. I mean, there's cake.
There's cake, too. Yeah. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. This is so freaking awesome.
I'm so excited you're going to be here. I, as soon as I called you to talk about what we're going to talk about and how would we make cake sound interesting, you made me not feel nervous about it at all. You just talk about it like I was eating it already.
That's because cake is awesome and easy to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we treat food as something that's esoteric and only available to people who learn to write beautifully when they're in English class. And it's like, no, you can talk about it. Mm-hmm. Everyone can talk about it. We're just not thinking about it. We're thinking about what it feels like and not just putting it to page.
Yeah. So Jess is going to, I have these cakes in front of me. They're very pretty. And she's going to teach me how to talk about it to you. So here we go.
Okay, so first off, consider that you were framed on how you would think about this cake before I walked in the door, before you opened the box. Why do you think that?
What do I think about it?
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was fascinating, this idea that I could be framed before I went on air. But you had given me an idea that I was going to taste a very specific type of cake.
Yes, not only that, I apparently can't get close enough to the mic. How I think about stuff means you're thinking, oh, Jess, she knows about dessert. She has a blog. I trust her opinion on cake. So whatever she's going to bring me, it's going to be tasty because she's bringing me the cake.
Mm-hmm.
Had someone else brought you the cake, you'd have a completely different idea of the cake beforehand. Just because it'd be like, oh, my friend's bringing me it. They only like whatever can go well with a PBR. Yeah, that's a very different thing than me being like, oh my god, you need to try this cake. You're gonna be like, yeah, it's gonna be good stuff. And so that's the first thing. No matter what, you're already thinking, this is gonna be good.
That's true.
And so I didn't have to tell you anything. Mm-hmm. I could tell you this is from a hole in the wall in the Central District, and you have to go up 2 flights of stairs. Or I could tell you it's from a fancy little cafe, and you pick it up, and everyone's so cheerful, and there's marble tablecloth settings and all the lovely things. And you'd probably believe me.
Now, I would.
Yeah. And neither of those is real.
Okay. Meaning those places don't exist, or that's not where this one's from?
Not where this one's from.
Okay.
Those are both kind of close. This is actually from Bakery Nouveau, which is in Capitol Hill or West Seattle, and the original store is in West Seattle. And this is, should I describe the cake?
Yeah.
This is the Phoenix cake. So everyone who's a dessert geek is like, oh god, she brought that cake. This is one of their most famous cakes. It's pretty much what put Bakery Nouveau on the map. Which also is, again, it's giving you a perception of, oh, this is like a really epic dessert. Now, you need to sort of push that aside.
Okay.
Not because it means anything bad, but because all of that, everything about what you just told you, is going to tell you something different. So if it's from a hole in the wall, you're going to have different expectations on the cake versus from someplace that looks gorgeous, like canless, mm-hmm. versus going to dim sum. You're going to have such different ideas of how it should be and how it should taste.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it's still worth knowing that because you can go, oh, hey, I'm thinking this way because it's so pretty or it's so expensive. And if you don't have that in mind, you're going to be having a different idea of how you should frame things for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I'm going to have a different experience than you no matter what, because I've already had this cake.
Okay.
And I have memories associated with this cake. I'm going to tell you later about the cake if you want, but for me, I have memories, and so I'm going to have layered expectations of how it should taste based off of the previous cakes.
Isn't she so detailed in how she's talking about this?
Well,
we haven't even gotten into tasting anything.
I know. I'm delaying the gratitude here and the gratification. I know. Yeah, I get to the good stuff. Okay. So for you, it's a new experience, and that's the cool stuff because you're going to be like, oh, wow, when you hit it. So before we get started, do you want to describe for me what the cake looks like on the outside? What does it remind you of anything?
Yeah, reminds me of a caramel, like a caramel candy.
Yeah. And remember, folks at home, she has no idea what's in the cake yet.
So. I don't. I have no idea. I didn't even look it up online.
Yeah, so this is going to be interesting. All right, so keep going.
So it looks like a caramel, Except for that it would be like a very high caramel, because a caramel might be more like a disc. This is more like taller. And so it's got these chocolate flecks around the, what do we call those?
Like, little squares, little tiles.
Little tiles, yeah, little tiles that go around the outside.
What does it remind you of? Have you seen a dessert like this before? Does it look like a certain location? Is there anything like that?
Well, like I said, it looks between a mix between a caramel and a top hat.
There you go. That's awesome. Seriously. Like, when I look at it, I think of, like, it's a very classical French style to me. That glaze is also really popular right now with a lot of Russian food bloggers who are doing those really pretty galaxy glazes. And you're like, I could never make that happen. I'm not that cool. but this feels like a celebration to me. When I look at it, I'm like, oh, this is special. And actually, when you open the box, you gasped. You're like, oh my goodness, this is so cool.
That's true. I did do that.
And that's what I feel when I see the cake. It's like, oh, this is amazing. Okay, so the cool part is when we cut it open. So I'm going to go do that.
Okay.
And I'll eat the chocolate on top.
I'm going to tell you soon here why this person knows so much about desserts. We're going to get into that after we do this tasting. And she's going to make me sound cool, she promised.
Working on it. So, all right. Check it out now. We've got it open and cross-sectioned. What does it look like? What are you thinking now?
It's like a bridge.
That's important. No, seriously. Like, what do you see? What do you smell? Do you smell anything?
No, not yet. Should I get close to it?
Yes.
It smells like caramel to me.
There we go. Also, a good way to start is to taste the chocolate. So you're going to put the chocolate, take a tile, put it on your tongue, let it melt. Don't chew it. Now, while she's talking about that, we can think about the senses. You think about how smooth it is. You're thinking about how it melts on the tongue. Also going into, like, what notes hit you first? Is it caramel? Is it just a fudgy note? Is it, like, pokey? I've had chocolate that tastes like the chocolate pokey biscuits you get from Awajimaya. Is it sweet? Is it sour? Does it have a cherry note? And there's no wrong answer here, so don't feel like, oh, it's not like there's no exact science to chocolate.
It's more like a bitter chocolate.
Oh, that's pretty cool. But does it feel like, does it remind you of anything?
Not especially.
Okay, that's not a bad thing. Okay. It means that it's new to you, and that's awesome.
Okay,
take your first bite.
Okay, guys. I'm, like, kind of nervous about how I'm going to take my first bite.
So while she's doing that, I can talk about what I'm thinking about it. We've got this really fluffy mousse, and I'm not going to say much more because you need to take her first bite. And let's see what she thinks. So what hits you first?
Well, it's very, there's a lot of, like, a whipped cream taste, like, feeling. Actually, the first thing is the way it feels. It has this, whipped cream, but not whipped cream, like, it's light whipped cream, like, it's condensed and packed together. And then very, like, butterscotch.
Yeah, keep going, like.
Butterscotch, and then kind of, like, a buttery taste. So, like caramely butterscotch, I guess. I don't know. I'm not really super familiar with a butterscotch,
but
it has, like, a buttery caramel flavor.
Okay, take a bite from the center. So, for those at home, this guy is a layered mousse cake. It's got a caramel mousse on the exterior and a caramel glaze on top. And then it's also got layers like pecan and pear. So there's a lot going on in here, and it can be hard to taste everything. But that's okay, because it's a teeny, teeny little cake.
This is a lot of pressure.
No, it's okay. Do you want me to taste it and talk about it? Would that be helpful?
No, I feel like I have to persevere.
No, you're doing great.
Okay, so it tastes like pecans.
Yeah.
And kind of like a, I'm going to say nutmeg. Kind of like a nutmeg taste.
Go for it. What are you tasting? What,
like, pecan nutmeg, it reminds me of, it doesn't taste like pumpkins, but it has, like, something similar to like a pumpkin pie.
That's awesome. So, what do you taste at the end? Like, if you breathe in through your mouth and breathe out your nose, what are you tasting? And then also breathe in through your nose and out your mouth. Yoga techniques for dessert eating.
It's kind of like butter.
And is that a bad thing?
I'm surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that neat?
Yeah, it's neat. It's so, different. But I'm also, I think I don't have the right answer.
There's no right answer. So when I look at a dessert, there's a couple things I'm looking at. Mm-hmm. My history with it, whether with the particular dessert we've got here, mm-hmm. or whatever I know about the history of a dessert. Like, I know a lot about cream puffs and how they should be structured.
Mm-hmm.
And we're taking photos of the lovely little Phoenix cake. So with this guy, I have a lot of memory of the mousse, and so I have expectations about it.
Mm-hmm.
And with this guy, I'd be like, okay, we've got all the layers. We've got this caramel glaze. It's very sweet. It's sort of a entry note. Let's go for what you were saying. We've got butterscotch. We've got a butter finish. It's fluffy, but it's densely fluffy.
Yeah.
More like a whipped custard rather than a whipped cream.
Yeah. That would be a good word, custard.
And it's reminding you of eating a pumpkin pie. You've got the taste of fall in it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just taking your words and making them sound pretty.
You sound amazing when you say it.
And that's quite close to how it feels to me. For me, this is what I've eaten for a lot of my anniversaries with my spouse. We've been together 12 years in October, and he's probably like, oh God, you're mentioning me on the air. Mm-hmm. And for me, when I have this, I think of eating it nearly melting in a box, just sitting there together. Or the first time we got it, we're like, what is this thing? It's so cool. And as it was a treat and not one I normally got when I've lived here most of my life, and we didn't order it when I was a kid, but it was this special thing that was a rare treat. And still, you have this very sweet opening note that the glaze almost melts in the tongue, and then you have the softness of the mousse giving way to that pecan soft crunch.
Mm-hmm.
And then, again, it feels like fall. It's a very fall dessert, especially with the notes of pear. They mm-hmm. give kind of a mellowness to the back. So if you tried it now, since I've told you there's pear in it, you're going to be going and hunting for it.
Okay.
But you're like, oh, God, to eat more cake on air. Darn, my life is so hard right now. A person is making me eat cake.
I told my trainer I was going to be doing this on air, and she was like, what? And I was like, no, it's going to be cool.
But yeah. When you're thinking about dessert, there's no right or wrong way to do about any of it. But I look at, like, all the senses. How does it melt on the tongue? How does it feel? Not just mouth feel, but is it crunchy? Is it a little crunchy? Is it crunchy at the beginning? Where do you feel each of the components hit you? Which hits first? Which hits last? And all of that goes together with how you're feeling in that moment. Like, we're eating it right now in a soundproofed room with white walls. And it's kind of late, and we're kind of probably a bit tired, and you went to the gym today. And it's like, all that combines in how you're feeling about this cake mm-hmm. right now. And so actually, it's one of the reasons why if I'm training someone who wants to do food reviews, I would say never go when you're very tired or even a little sick. Because I once did a review while pretty much nauseous and didn't realize it till halfway through, which was a nightmare. But that's all you need to think about. All it is how you're experiencing it in this moment, coupled with what knowledge you're bringing to the table about that dessert. And that's it.
Well, it was a very interesting dessert. I was surprised. I could tell how the mousse and the custard came forward, like more forward in my tongue as I was eating it with like the nuts. But I never did taste the pear.
That's how it goes. Cake for me now.
Okay, so I want to tell you, I want to get to know a little bit more about you and how other people can come and learn more about your tasting. So tell me about, one of the things that I thought was really interesting when we were talking about this concept of framing me for how, which is what you were talking about, is how the expectations that I would have before I would taste it.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things that she would have told me, I shouldn't look it up online much. So, but it was such an interesting concept, the idea that I might be framed if I had a perception of it ahead of time.
Oh, yeah. Framing is everywhere. I mean, the whole concept of what expectations you go into a room, how you dress, how you're feeling, all of that combines into it. And for me, the more I'm aware of my bias, the better a job I'll do at my writing. Mm-hmm. And even if I just write the top, I'm feeling kind of cruddy right now, but I can still write. It's kind of gross out. I've had a bad day.
Mm-hmm.
All of that means that I can go, okay, was I having a bad moment when I tasted this? And if I'm having too bad of a moment, I will walk out the door and make another appointment.
Because
it's not worth it. Because that impact of how you're feeling and how you're anchored in that moment is just so powerful that I talk to people about chocolate tasting.
It colors your perception,
oh, yeah.
Right? It's coloring your experience.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have to cough. Lovely. But all of it, I mean, even different times of day can impact how you taste something, which is impressive as I knock things about.
Well, it's the same way with when people produce things. You know, what you think about who you are affects how you show up in the world. That's why, you know, if you want to strengthen your brand, like for your company or whatever, most important thing you could do is, you know, strengthen your own sense of who you are.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you once ate at, this is like a fun fact about Jess, you once ate at every Tom Douglas restaurant in Seattle,
yep.
And they were in one day.
Yep, actually 12 hours.
12 hours, one restaurant an hour.
Yep.
Why did you do that?
Because I could. Well, I was looking into fun things to do around Seattle. I am from Bellevue and then moved to Seattle a few years ago. And I was like, you know, there are some cool things I can do. I like eating. I like eating a lot. And I just barely started blogging and decided I'll try eating at them. Then I realized, oh, I can do it in one day. Because I was always going to do a couple days. Like, oh, one day is possible. Mm-hmm. I can take one day off.
Mm-hmm.
I can do one day of eating. And at the time, my spouse was working at Amazon. So I could crash in his office, or at least near his office, and get a nap in. Because you really need a nap when you eat that much in a day. But what was neat about it, actually, was that I originally was going to do it by myself. Just super quiet, stealth mode activated, totally in out. So I get to C-Town, and Liana, who was working there at the time, I went up to her and said, hey, can you just give me something small? I have 9 more restaurants to go, and I'm kind of beat up already. And Lauren, who was then the manager, she's now the manager at Serious Pie, was like, do you have a schedule? What is this? And what's going on? And I'm like, here, have a copy of my schedule. And this woman, bless her heart, sent it to the entire Tom Douglas team. And so from that point on, everyone knew who I was. They all knew I was coming. And they just started feeding me. And oh my God. And even Tom showed up himself at one point, which was hilarious because it was at Serious Pie, Virginia. And I walked up to this couple and I was like, look, can I buy a slice of pizza off you for $5? Because it's not happy hour and, oh my goodness, I cannot eat a whole pie. And they're like, who's this person? And then Tom Douglas walks in. And they're all, that's Tom Douglas. I'm like, yeah, that's Tom Douglas. And so that happened. And then at Cuoco, which was the second to last restaurant, they're all, we know you've been eating all day, but you need to try these 3 dishes.
Oh,
and I nearly broke down in tears. I mean, it was so kind of them, it was so sweet, but I was so peed up, and I just wanted to hide in a ball somewhere, and I'd been eating from like 8 a.m. to 8 p.m.-ish, so I get to the last one at Palace Kitchen, and they're all, how do you like your dessert? And just like, I'm so not here. It's really such an unusual experience. It's hard to really explain to people what it's like eating for 12 hours.
It'd be like kind of like, yeah, a hot dog eating contest, sort of.
Yeah. It's like having a marathon of food. And I think I walked 5 miles that day.
But I just still don't understand why and where you came up with this idea and what the heck, you were just going to write, like, you were like, I have a great idea for an article.
Yeah.
Kind of what you're, okay.
Yeah, I was like, I had my tiny blog at the time, Ricochet Biscuit, and I was like, I'm just going to do this. And I've always liked having ridiculous adventures. And it sounded so fun. Like, how do you do that? What goes into that? And I like planning, so I went and made a schedule, and I found my itinerary and went, this is functional, this is doable. Okay. And everyone thought I was out of my mind, but apparently, actually, after I finished it, I started a trend. There were people trying to do it. No one ever did the 12 hours, which is reasonable, but it was a thing for a while. Like, people were coming and doing 2 days of Tom Douglas, and he even made a mini tour as an auction item that year.
Wow.
And I wish I'd gotten it, because that would have been awesome. But, you know, it was a thing. And I considered doing it again this year, because I relaunched my Instagram, and it's really hard to do it now. There's like 15 restaurants. They're all over the map. And I was like, I'm going to have to need a bigger group. So we'll see. But that's what I love doing. I love doing large adventures in search of food.
And you are about to do Sweet Week.
Oh, yeah.
And that's also a crazy goal, too, right? It's like 25 desserts in 4 days?
It's 30 desserts now.
Uh-oh. You keep saying yes.
Well, it's So Sweet Vegas is just a planned event. And mm-hmm. I went, I don't really want to be an official part, but I love eating and I love exploring. And there's a lot of places on the list that I haven't been to yet. And I was like, you know, this gives me a chance to go adventuring. I'm in. And I thought it was going to be, you know, five a day. I can do it. I can plunk it out. And they're like 30. And I'm all, you're mean, but I accept this challenge. And it's supposed to be 7 days, but I'm doing it in five so that if anything goes wrong, I have time. Because that way, and also then I can go on a huge salad adventure of my own the next week and recover.
And what will you do in this Sweet Way? Like, you'll taste the desserts and then write about them and take pictures? Like, tell me about what you're going to do.
I'm probably going to post my favorites on Instagram and then put everything on Instagram stories. I haven't decided yet because with 30, mm-hmm. I could spend a whole month just doing that. But mm-hmm. people can only eat it for a week. So yeah. I'm thinking more likely Instagram stories and Twitter. I might do an article. I haven't decided on just, it's like there's so much content. I might get to the end and be like, Instagram was enough. I wrote 10 articles. I'm good. We'll see. It's more about how many desserts can I try? What's going on in the Seattle scene? Because there's so much going on right now. And we've got a bunch of new places opening up very soon after Sweet Week. One's actually opening its shop during Sweet Week, Hood mm-hmm. Famous. So I'm really excited to see what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So it's just a chance to sort of say hi and see who's in the neighborhood.
Well, and as you bring up being in the neighborhood, and aren't you're creating some dessert map?
Yep.
What does that?
So I've been noticing that everyone wants to know where the desserts are on Instagram. I put the locations on it, but they're like, where do you go? Like, I always say that the one question I can't answer is what's my favorite dessert, because I just go deer in headlights. Like, I can't do that. I'll have to look at my feed and see what looked good in the last week.
You're a lover of all things.
Well, there's so many different desserts.
Yeah.
And asking to pick a favorite is like the favorite child question. You can't answer it. Yeah. And since everyone's asking me, where do you go? I originally started making walking maps. And I was like, wait, why am I not just making a map? And so I made a test run with Pike Pine, because that's like, if you haven't been to Seattle, Pike Pine and Madison is this triangle area bordered by Broadway. And there's the ridiculous dessert density. We're talking like 6 dessert shops just for ice cream, and then 6 or 7 pastry shops. It's intense. And so that to me is like, if you're going to go to Seattle and you need to see like one zone of dessert, you go to Pike Pine. And so I went, okay, I'll make a map. I'll see what people think. If people like it, I'll make more maps. I'm hope, and when I put it up, I immediately got bakeries going, why am I not on the map? And I'm like, you're not on the map. You're off like several pages from the map. So, I mean, I love you, just you're not physically on this part of the map. It's too tiny. And so I'm now working through all of my Instagram content, and I'm going to be putting it all on this map and then hopefully expand it over time. So I'm thinking end of the year I'll have most of the stuff going on.
And how do the people are listening, how do they find the map?
It is on SeattleDessertGeek.com. I will be uploading that to SeattleDessertMap.com. But if that's way too long, SuperJust.com has everything. Don't worry. You're good.
Okay, cool. So I want to know, when people say, what do you do? What do you say?
I say, what section of my work are you looking at? I think of myself as doing two things. I'm one part social media wizard. I call myself a muse for hire. And one part Seattle dessert geek. Mm-hmm. And I don't consider myself a historian of dessert. It's more just this guide to dessert. And I'm a geek because I'm a science geek, and being a geek is awesome. So there we go. And so I do both all sorts of dessert stuff, and I think of myself like being a social media tailor. You have a great idea, a great outfit. I just make sure it fits just so.
Okay. And, okay, so you're, and this is very interesting, you're like a personality, obviously.
Thank you.
So how did you get into this? Where did you go to school for food? And you're also a photographer, so yes. Obviously that helps like your marketing and your social media and all this stuff. So how did you end up in both? See, did you get a degree for being a dessert geek?
I wish. I would be in for that. Okay, UW, if you're listening, I'm willing to be a professor. Let's just say that. Okay, so my course to being this, what I am now, was awkward in that I have a Bachelor's of Science in Biology.
Okay.
And I have a Master of Public Administration. and I have a certificate in business and an all but thesis master's of science in forestry.
Okay.
So I have 2.5 completed degrees, none of which are in media. It's fun. What happened was that I thought I was going to be a scientist. I love science. I've been in paleontology. I've been on digs in South Dakota, helped pull a fossilized shark out of a field. Super awesome. Except for the 100-degree part. No. And I wasn't ever feeling quite right. And in 2011, when I was in my first year of grad school in forestry, I decided to start a blog because I was taking pictures with my camera, and this was really cool, and I should put them somewhere on the internet. And at the same time, a publication was looking for beginning bloggers, and I'm all, I'm a beginning blogger, and turns out that most of my conversations are about food. And I apparently have, I've been confirmed on this, I have more chocolate in my kitchen than one of Valrhona's marketing offices.
Whose office?
Valrhona, the chocolate brand.
Oh.
I was at an event, and I was like, hey, I have a lot of chocolate in my kitchen. They're all, wait, you have more than our office. And I'm like, that's interesting. So I was mid-forestry degree and trying to figure if I wanted to continue in forestry. I've done the whole machete slinging, all that stuff. And I was like, you know, I'm spending all my free time talking about food. I'm not really working on my thesis here. This isn't a good sign for anybody who's in grad school. And I finished my MPA. I actually ended up, what really was kicker for me anyways, I got very sick in grad school while trying to be an editor for this online publication, and I ended up getting kicked out of grad school on doctor's orders for 6 months.
Oh.
And about the same time when I was returning, I was originally doing one thesis for 2 degrees, and they offered a degree project in my MPA on kitchen incubators, and I'm like, I want to do that. That sounds awesome. So those of you who don't know what that is, a kitchen incubator is like, it's a business incubator for businesses in the food industry. So they have a commercial kitchen and training. They're really awesome. And so what we did as a group, because it's a group project, was evaluating the potential for a kitchen incubator for Rainier Beach. And I continued in that. I'm actually part of the Food Innovation Network now as one of their media consultants. And I just went to, yeah, all I'm doing is talking about food. It's all I'm doing, all the time. Maybe I should do something about that. And I thought long and hard and realized that writing a full research paper on invasive rats wasn't going to be that helpful to the food systems, even though I love it. I have some stuff I might submit to Eater one day. And it was just, okay, I need to see where this goes because it's scary as crud. And my spouse went, all you do is talk about food. Go to swim with it. Do what makes you happy because I'm here to enable you, so go do it. It's like, okay, we'll take a test period and we'll see what happens. And now I nearly have 5,000 followers on Instagram. So that's pretty cool.
Well, that is very cool. And I think it's really interesting. One of the things with the way that you talk about food, I remember at one point I'm like, wow, you're so detailed. It is like you're a scientist of food.
I like that expression of it. Yeah. There's a lot to science that transfers to talking about food, because food is science and food is art and art is science and all that good stuff.
And isn't baked goods, or this would fit into baked goods, right? It's not really baked, though.
This is a pastry.
Pastry.
But it's not a baked pastry. This would be probably a set pastry. It might be cooked over a stove to get the custard.
Yeah.
Because it's got a little bit of an egg base to it. We'd have to ask Bakery Nouveau. But this is not going to be baked in an oven.
Okay, but aren't the... In the realm of cooking, isn't desserts and like pastries like the hardest thing because you have to like be very much more precise?
I don't think of them that hard, but I survived 2 years of chemistry class. So I think of them as it's what I feel comfortable in, actually. I feel uncomfortable trying to cook.
Mm-hmm. And is it because like you're more comfortable with the preciseness?
Yeah. The precision of baking to me feels great because, again, you survive organic chemistry, you can bake anything.
Yeah, and organic chemistry is hard. I didn't ever took it, but I dated a guy in college who did, and everybody failed out. Like, literally, it was like the whole thing. They were like, we got to get this teacher fired. But it was hardest class in their whole degree, according to the person that I know.
Oh, I think physical chemistry is scarier, but that's just personal preference. But organic chemistry is definitely, there's a lot to think about. And it does translate, the laboratories at least translate really well to thinking about pastry and baked goods.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I think is interesting is, like, how did you just decide, this is what I'm going to do and I'm going to make money off of talking about food? Like, you know, what were some of your challenges just owning that? And how did you find your voice?
Well, for one thing, I am incredibly risk averse. Things aside of being a scientist who's done a lot of risky things, I may have once pulled a grown man out of a stream. Don't do that. Do you want to hear that story?
No, I mean, it was very interesting, but I definitely would like to go
later.
Back. Yeah,
another day. But I've done a lot of things that were very risky in the field, and I don't like being more risky than I have to. And especially with work, I like very structured plans, and I make huge plans, and I'm all happy with them. And honestly, being a food personality is scary as crud. Because the other day, someone messaged me and said, "I think of you as a tastemaker," and I was all,
"Yeah,
I know I'm cool, but you know I'm cool. This is weird, and I don't know what to do with it." But it was still awesome of you. Thank you very much. It's the more I thought about it, the more I'm like, you know, I am spending 3 hours a day on Instagram just getting things done. I'm spending all my time on food. And while I love being a consultant and I have some amazing clients, I love them to pieces, I am really devoted into building up the Seattle food community as it relates to desserts. And I was like, you know what? If I don't own this, I'm not going to do what makes me happy. And I'm still sort of working through that because, yeah, imposter syndrome. I don't think I have true imposter syndrome. I think I'm doing awesome stuff and I'm pretty excited about it. But it's also this feeling of I don't know what to do when people think that I'm doing cool stuff. So I'm like, I know I'm cool. Like I said, I know I'm cool, but you think I'm cool and I don't know what to do about that.
Yeah.
And that's my version of imposter syndrome. But for me, it's as long as I have a plan, I can feel confident. So I go home and I have my end of quarter review and I was like, you know, I'm spending all my freaking time on Instagram, so let's just rock it and see what happens. And I will say here that I'm very lucky that my spouse is okay with me having these experiments. I'm very privileged in that way. And if my spouse wasn't able to let me just experiment like this, I would probably stay far more to my clients. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very grateful that he's able to let me do that. But I also want to acknowledge that because getting into food writing does require having often either a job or someone who can support you getting started. Once you're started, it's often a lot easier, but that first year is the toughest. Mm-hmm. So I have a thing where I'm going to check out on myself in like 6 months, and if I'm not where I want to be for all this stuff, I'm going to go back to being more of a consultant.
Okay, so for you, the hardest part was getting over the imposter syndrome and just really owning it, because it's unique and different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And scary. But fun scary. I get to do cool things.
Well, I want to give some tips before we go.
Oh, yeah.
So one of the things I'd love to hear first is, in a nutshell, how would you sum up your social media strategy? Like,
ooh, that's a fun one. Which social media strategy?
So that's a good question. Yeah. How does a person even say, you know, my social media strategy is X, Y, and Z?
Ooh, I don't even think that way. So my mentor is Erica Mills, who I haven't seen enough recently, and she's fantastic, and you should all check her out. She teaches at UW and now at Claxton University, her thing, which is really cool. And what she believes is the what, who, how. I follow a sub-format of that. For me, it's first, when I'm building my online strategy, I go back to looking at the ideal client or ideal reader, whatever you want to call it, your awesome person, the person you're going to talk to, your best bud, whatever you need to call it, this person who's going to be your biggest fan, and describe them, but not just like demographics. I definitely think about what makes them get up in the morning, what's scaring the crud out of them, what makes them miserable in their life, what they wish they could change about their life. And you can build your own versions called psychographics of what you need in order to feel confident that you understand this person's needs and desires and how you're solving them. And then now you have this person and you can go, okay, the what. What do I want to do with them? I want to reach them online. Who? That's my ideal person. Okay. So say for me, my ideal person, for the dessert geek, they want to show off to their friends, but they work at Amazon and they have no free time and they just really want to know what's going on the spot. And they want some inspiration because they're sick of eating from the same two cafeteria spots all day. Okay. So they're using Instagram and they're probably using Twitter or Facebook. I don't use Facebook enough, I should. So for them, that's where I'd be looking for them. I might do Snapchat, but I feel that my audience, my ideal reader, isn't necessarily using Snapchat for looking for food. So I don't feel as like I need to go there. But also look at, okay, one am I comfortable doing? Because really you should pick two, when you're, especially when you're starting out. And for me, I went, you know, I like Twitter. I really like Twitter chats. And I really like Instagram. Okay, I'm going to rock those two. Because no matter what, whatever you show up consistently at, it's going to matter the most. So that's how I start strategy. And then you just have to look at it and test it, and test it regularly. I test Instagram for my strategy on it about once every 1 to 2 months. And I have a lot of analytics going so I can check out how I'm doing.
Okay, cool. And so one tip for us, just, you know, for us general people using social media who don't have a strategy yet, what could we do to be more of ourselves in social media?
Read your work out loud. Before you post it, read it out loud. Does it sound like you? Because, for example, when I'm writing online, like doing IMs, I am very formal and very organized and very polite. But if you're listening to me right now, my voice goes up and down, and I honestly swear like a sailor when I'm at home, and that doesn't come out, I feel like, if I'm doing my IM voice. So if I'm not sure if it sounds like me, I just say it out loud before I hit send. And that alone means you aren't going to sound like a robot. And that is the mark of doom online. Do not sound like a robot. Just read it out loud. I don't care if it sounds weird to do it, because it'll sound really weird when you get started. First couple times, you're all, what am I doing? But after you've done a couple times, like, I still read my work out loud. Not every single sentence anymore, but usually a good chunk of it. If I'm like, this tweet sounds weird, I'll read it. It's so beneficial and so easy to do. And we're scared to do that.
Yeah, well, that's great advice, actually. I'd never even considered it, but it does make sense. You know, when you talk and you're doing social media, you're expressing through your voice in a way, right?
Oh, yeah.
Not the same as writing a formal report or something.
Oh, yeah. And I actually have one sub thing on that that I think is super important, especially if you're someone who identifies as a lady in this world. Whenever you say, I'm sorry, and it's not an apology for doing something wrong, add on, I'm not sorry, and add on, why? That little thing. That's it.
So I'm sorry, I'm not sorry, because, like, I love cake?
Yeah. Like, whenever you say I'm sorry as an expression, like, I'm sorry for opening the door, I'm sorry for bothering you.
Mm-hmm.
At least at home, get in the habit of saying, oh, I'm not sorry. I'm not sorry because I deserve this blasted cake. I deserve everything coming to me. I should not be apologizing. Mm-hmm. And that was huge for me. It got my I'm sorry's down by like half in the first month of using it once I got the hang of it. And I found that my confidence just was so much better. And I'm now actually personally working on reducing the word but from my conversations. I found that, to me, that's a reducing of what I'm saying phrase. And so, but starting with the I'm not sorry, it's so critical. And it's so amazing. Like, the results, like, I did not realize it would be so powerful to be like, I'm not sorry. I'm not sorry. This is cool.
Yeah, I have the right to speak my voice.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I like that. That's good.
And if you're going to be yourself online, you have to be able to be that level of confident, because it's scary. All this is scary. And that little bit of extra confidence can mean the world about saying what you want to say online.
Well, thank you so much, Jess. This has been so helpful. I know I learned a lot, and I'm sure everybody is like, oh my gosh, I never thought about social media like that. And your voice is so, so interesting.
Oh, thank you.
It's really beautiful, and you do a really good job expressing your emotions through your words.
Thank you. I'm liking how your voice sounds on radio, too.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And thank you for listening in. This is Radically Distinct Radio and Jen Morgan. One of the things that's radically distinct about Jess is how confident she communicates. From the moment I met her and all the way through the radio show, she came across with such a bright, clear, and resonant sounding voice. Not only was the content she was talking about interesting and coming across like an expert, but the tone of her voice made me feel like I wanted to listen to her. She said one thing right at the top of the interview that gives us insight into how she shows up this way. She said, "The more aware you are of your bias, the better your writing will be." I totally agree. And I would add, the more aware you are of your bias, the better communicator you are, and the more powerful you show up in the world. What does it mean to be aware of your bias? It means that you're understanding that your thoughts, feelings, and beliefs from the past and in the moment color your perception. Your perception includes assumptions you hold about what is possible and what you believe to be true, how your day is going, and how you feel about yourself and life overall.
It also includes things you've learned through your experiences and what other people have told you. All those things color your point of view, and they make each of us have very different points of view from one another. This means we have different perspectives because we have different life experiences. Your voice is unique because you're radically distinct. And as you start to focus on what that is about yourself, your voice gets stronger and more confident because you're knowing where you're coming from. You believe in yourself. You're not trying to be like other people. Instead, you're focusing on knowing your own perspective. And as Jess advised, you eventually stop apologizing for having a point of view when you let yourself have one. You have the right to your point of view. Your perspective is radically distinct. And if you don't share it, who will?
Hey, this is Jen Morgan. I want to empower you to be radically distinct. And there are many ways for us to work together. Whether you're an individual working on your career path or your life status, or you're a team or an organization, get a hold of me, jenmorgan.com. That's Jen with two N's, morgan.com. Email me, j@jenmorgan.com, and follow the show on Instagram and Facebook @radicallydistinct.